From east to west and kingdom to kingdom, you're listening to the Diz Unplugged Connecting with Walt podcast. Connecting with Walt is brought to you by Dreams Unlimited Travel, experts at helping you plan the perfect Disney vacation. Visit them on the web at www.dreamsunlimitedtravel.com. Hello, and welcome to our new series on the Diz Unplugged, Connecting with Walt. I am your host, Michael Bowling, and I'm joined by my co-host and producer, Craig Williams.
Hey, everyone.
Hey, Craig. Well, this is exciting. We're here at the birth of a brand new Diz Unplugged podcast show.
I know. It's only my second time that I actually can say I've been a part of a first show. So just this and my Universal show.
So. This is exciting. So people don't have to go into the archives to catch up.
I know, it's the best thing. And for people who aren't getting on board right away and they're listening to this like 10 years into the future, I don't know what you were thinking.
So. Really? And I'm buried beneath Pirates of the Caribbean at Disneyland.
Let's not go there.
Anyway, so for listeners of the Diz Unplugged Orlando show, you may not know who I am. I'm part of the Diz Unplugged Disneyland podcast team, along with Nancy Johnson, Mary Jo Mulatto-Willie, Tony Spitel, and our host Tom Bell, where we talk about Disneyland, Southern California attractions, and the Walt Disney Family Museum events in San Francisco. You may have seen me as a part of the Diz's team coverage on the last two D23 expos and the recent Disneyland 7 and 7 reviews. I'm also the historian for the Diz and focus on Disney history on the Disneyland podcast. So, Craig, would you like to introduce yourself to listeners who might be hearing you for the first time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for those of you out there who do watch or listen to the Walt Disney World show, you should know so much more about me. If you've never paid attention to what I've talked about, then shame on you again. But no, for everyone who's not really informed with me, I am currently the producer of the Diz Unplugged, and I am in charge of video, and I essentially just... I run around with a camera like a crazy person at all the Disney parks, and if you've seen any of our videos on YouTube, there's a chance that I've had a hand in it, and especially the ones with Disneyland. I love going out there and doing as much as I can with video, especially like this past year with the 60th anniversary, being out there and seeing all that for the first time. My goodness, that was an experience that I'll never forget. But I came down here, and I originally worked for Disney as part of the college program before then moving over to the dark side, as everyone calls it, but I absolutely hate, to Universal Orlando, where I spent a great amount of time there and really built up myself quickly there. But then whenever I was getting ready to move on to another position with Universal, that's whenever Pete plucked me out of there and brought me on board so I could start finally doing something with my college degree that I worked so hard to get. And here I am now, all these years later.
Yeah, and well, for me, I got into Disney fairly young. Back when Disneyland was celebrating its 10th anniversary, its tencennial, Walt was considering restarting the Mickey Mouse Club because he saw it having a new club for every generation. So to sort of test the waters, we had a chapter of the Mickey Mouse Club at Disneyland in the 60s, and I was one of the Mouseketeers for that chapter. We didn't move on, and we did not get into television, unfortunately. The decision was made to re-syndicate the original club into 30-minute segments, it was a little more cost-effective than starting up a new club. But they did have new clubs in the 70s and 80s, so they did carry on Walt's, you know, original vision of having a new club for every generation. And then I went into teaching and enjoyed that, and I still continue to do that. And But I always had a great love for Disney my whole life. And so when I got to know folks on the Diz Unplugged, my wife and I traveled with them, and I started to go to the Walt Disney Family Museum a lot. Pete invited me to write about some of the events about the Walt Disney Family Museum on the Diz blog. So I did that, and then November 20th, 2013, Tom Bell, who's the host and producer of the Disneyland show, invited me on as a special guest to report on the Walt Disney Family Museum. They were doing their very first major exhibition, which was on the making of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. So I came on and did that. And about 2 weeks later, Tom invited me on again to be a full participant in the show and told me just to be fully prepared to take part in it. And I thought, I wonder if I'm being auditioned. So I went ahead and, did that. And about 2 weeks later, Tom contacted me and offered me a position on the Disneyland show. And gosh, about a year. Pete made me a full team member of the Diz Unplugged, mm-hmm. and I became the Disney historian for the show because that's my area of expertise on the Disneyland show. I've been running two history series, the 60 Years of Disneyland and Windows on Main Street, I talk with people who actually have a window on Main Street or with people who worked closely with them. So our listeners who primarily visit Disney World have expressed interest in a show that covers the history of Walt Disney World, and that's why Craig and I are launching this new Diz Unplugged podcast, Connecting with Walt.
And I'm super excited about this because, just in general, of doing more work with history, it's something that you and I have been trying to accomplish for a while, basically since we've met each other and started working together. We've been interested in history, and we tried to get our history series of videos going too, and hopefully there's still time for that, and we can make more time to do it. But at the same time, I'm so excited about this new podcast and really getting to dive into Walt Disney World history, since that's I arguably know more about that than Disneyland, but I can't wait to see what new things I actually get to learn from you.
Yeah, and because you were a cast member at Disney World, I was one at Disneyland, I'm looking forward to learning a whole lot more about Disney World from you.
Exactly.
And we chose October to inaugurate the series because on October 1st, 1971, the Walt Disney Resort officially opened. And this is the Walt Disney Resort I first visited when I was a teenager. It included the Magic Kingdom, Disney's Contemporary Resort, Disney's Polynesian Resort, and Disney's Fort Wilderness Resort and Campground. So happy 44th anniversary to Walt Disney World. And we're looking forward to the 45th anniversary celebration.
Oh, yeah. Hopefully it'll be just as good as the 40th anniversary.
Yeah. Which... Now, Craig... Oh, go ahead.
No, that was a nightmare. So I know. I mean, that was before...
Why was it a nightmare?
It was before I was on the Diz team, but I know Kevin still loves talking about it. Kevin Close on the Disney World show. And his big criticism was they barely made any of like the special cupcakes that they were raving on and on about it. And I was there that night with my family, and they were promising that they were going to do a special version of Wishes, and they did deliver. It was Wishes, but with a perimeter ending where they shoot the fireworks off from the 180 degree angle, which is really awesome to watch. But the park it had to be at near capacity if it didn't hit capacity. So it was just way too many people in there to watch a fireworks show that was really not that much more special for this anniversary that should have been massive and huge. So 45th anniversary, I'll skip that and I'll wait for the 50th anniversary coming up in another couple years.
Oh, I don't know. I'm going to be there for the 45th. But the Disneyland learned from Kevin's lamenting, because we had cupcakes at ours from morning till night at Disneyland and in every Disney resort hotel.
Yeah, that's what I saw on social media. It looked insane.
It was. And they were good.
Yeah, good.
So, Craig, when did you first visit Disney World? Do you remember your first time?
Oh, my gosh. In terms of remembering, no, I don't really remember. That's just a lack of me doing way too many harmful things to my brain with sports and other stuff. But I know that I probably visited for the first time whenever I was just an infant, first couple years old. Then my family started taking family vacations down to Disney World every couple years. I know I went whenever I was 5, 7, and 9. So that would have been 1992, 94, 96. And those are the classic years that I barely remember anything about. But if I could go back in time, these are the ones that I'd really, really, really want to be there to remember them all over again. Because the pictures that I have of being there at this era, it just, it's nostalgia, if that's anything. But then we took a couple of years off at Disney World, and then in about 2000, well, it was 2000 because we had the big 2000 celebration, and that's whenever we started coming again more regularly, and came every other year about that again. But then my sister ended up becoming a cast member as part of the college program, and once she did that, then all of a sudden it became that we are coming down to Disney World a couple times a year, and I am completely sure that that's why I eventually made the decision to do the exact same. But no, Disney World has always been a big part of my life for as long as I can remember. And it's been cool to see it progress through the years. And I just, you know, I wish I could remember more, but I read a lot about it, so I remember it that way.
Yeah, now for me, since Disneyland was my home park, I don't remember my first visit because I was 1 year old. But I do remember my first visit to Disney World because I was a teenager, and I had an aunt and uncle that who lived in Orlando. And so I visited them, and my aunt took me to Disney World, which is just the Magic Kingdom at the time. And the problem is she didn't care for going on attractions. Mm-hmm. And so we did the People Mover, and we did a few things like that. But I wanted to go on, you know, the Space Mountain, and I wanted to go on some of the other attractions. So I never did get to go on those until I went back years later. But I was amazed by its size. Primarily, because...
Sorry, what year was the first time that you actually got to visit?
That's what I'm trying to think of. It would have been 74, 75. No, it would have been 73. Would have been my first time.
Very cool.
So, anyway, and yeah, it was just the size is what amazed me. Because, you know, Disneyland would fit in the parking lot. It's very intimate.
Exactly. But at the same time, whenever I get to Disneyland, it feels massive to me for some reason. I mean, but that being said, the new Walt Disney World, especially Magic Kingdom speaking exclusively, it is become so concrete and lost a lot of that that greenery that still takes over so much of Disneyland, that the park is starting to feel bigger and bigger and bigger now to me than before. But, you know, it always blows my mind when I hear people say how massive the Magic Kingdom alone feels, because Disneyland just, it feels just as big, if not bigger to me.
Yeah. I think, well, it's funny because when you think that Disneyland has more attractions than the Magic Kingdom and it's smaller, I think that's what gives it its bigness. And yeah, it does have a lushness.
Yeah.
It's not all flat. You know, we have vistas and things. And I think at Disney World, it seems larger because it, you know, there's space between the attractions.
Exactly. Yeah.
And, you know, the joke with us is when you get off of an attraction, you're in the queue for the next one.
Hey, I mean, it's good for people who like bouncing from attraction to attraction.
Yeah. So no, let's go back even further though. I was at a D23 event last weekend, and they have a new theme now. And their theme for this year is, when did it start for you? Hmm. So when did Disney start for you, Craig?
Oh, my gosh. You know, I think I have that 80s child syndrome, even though I was born in the late 80s, but I never grew up not knowing anything but Disney movies and Disney Channel, because, you know, back then that's whenever Disney Channel would it was still a paid service, not free like it is today. So my parents did that for us, so we'd have some more healthy television to watch than some of the stuff that was on Nickelodeon at the time, even though we got into that as well. But Disney has just always been there, and I've always been obsessed with the movies. And then whenever we got to visit Disney World, then it added that element onto it. And then after that, for a while in the 90s there, Disney was putting a lot of Disney World related content on the Disney Channel. As I believe there was a series called Walt Disney World Inside Out that George yes. Foreman was even a part of for a while. And so, like, having that little bits and pieces to take in while we were at home and we couldn't be there, it fueled all of it even more. So yeah, Disney has just always captivated me from the absolute start, definitely with the movies. And then it just fluctuates at this point. Then it goes back and forth from the parks to the movies. And even just now, I have an obsession with collecting every art book that I can and just really diving into the artwork behind everything, whether it is the parks or movies. And yeah, it's clear that Disney has enveloped my life since I've started working with the Diz, especially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for me, it started early. Like I said, I went to Disneyland when I was 1 year old. But as Pete said, when we did the Disneyland 7 and 7, you know, Disney, growing up in California, Disneyland was a part of California culture. I mean, you went there like once a year, at least for a vacation, yeah. Or once every couple of years. But I'm of the generation who grew up with Walt Disney on television every week. And it was Disney films in the theaters. I remember one of my earliest memories, my father went away on a rare business trip, and he had promised he'd bring something back for me. And when he came home very late, but I was staying up late. And so, I asked him, oh, what did you bring me? I remember he brought me a little golden book of Sleeping Beauty and a Disney Sleeping Beauty. And I was so excited and all that. So that's my first probably Disney memory.
That's awesome.
And yeah. And, anyway, so yeah, it's just, and it's also just been part of my life forever. I mean, I'm sitting in my study, which is also the studio, and I have a giant Mickey Mouse chair my room from Walt Disney World. And, you know, I'm surrounded by Sorcerer Mickey items and things like that.
That chair, it's just so funny to think that it came all the way from here, went out to D23 to just go home with you.
I know. Isn't that funny? And we're waiting to see if in the next D23 Expo, if Pete or John are going to want us to bring it back down.
It'll cost them.
Yeah. Now you might be asking, why is this show called Connecting with Walt? And Connecting with Walt, we're going to delve into the motivations, innovations, and creativity of Walt Disney, his Imagineers, the artists, and animators, by exploring the backstories and history of not just the Disney theme parks and resorts and attractions. We're going to look into live action and animated films and other noteworthy events in the Disney company history. But each segment topic will always connect with Walt Disney's philosophy, planning, foresight, and imagination, because you'll be surprised at even things modern day, even such as Pandora, you know, the land of Avatar, will have a connection back to Walt, either his philosophy or his vision. And those are the kind of things we're always going to explore, that it always goes back to Walt. This is also going to be a slightly different podcast than the other Diz Unplugged shows. 4 to 5 episodes of Connecting with Walt will be released every 3 months on Fridays as an audio podcast. So we're not going to be a weekly podcast. We're going to be an event podcast. So every 3 months, you're going to get a full month of us, and then you'll have to wait another 3 months, and then we'll have another full month of podcasts. And one of the reasons for this is that it enables us to tie the segments together in a common topic, or or present a theme month. For example, we could do a series of segments on Disney films or Disney attractions having noteworthy anniversaries in a year. But what we're really going to start looking at first is Walt Disney World and how did it come to be. So what was Walt's inspiration for Disney World? Now, Walt passed away before Disney World was built, you know, on December 15th, 1966, at the age of 65 of lung cancer after a lifetime of smoking unfiltered Lucky Strike cigarettes. And Edith Efron in TV Guide wrote, "He is one of the few men in show business whose name stands for something significantly larger than their work. To say Walt Disney is to pay subtle compliment to the human race." And science fiction author Ray Bradbury remembered a time when Walt told him, "Nothing has to die." And Bradbury wrote, "Walt was right. Nothing has to die. Just rebuild it. Steamboat America lost? Carve a river bottom, flood it, and send your Mark Twain paddle wheel down the riverway. Victorian train travel gone? Nail up a Rococo scrimshaw Nail up a Rococo scrimshaw station, steam in a 19th century locomotive, and carry passengers from Civil War territories through African jungles into AD 2000. Disneyland was a way to live forever, and that included Walt himself. Now, Roy O. Disney stepped in and said shortly after his brother's death, "All of the plans that Walt had begun will continue to move ahead without interruption." Roy was confident in the company he and his brother had built over a lifetime. Talking about his brother, Roy O. Disney said, "He was the damnest planner I ever saw. He loved planning things that might be 3, 5, 10 years in the future. That's what was so unusual about the fellow. He could take care of matters at hand while dreaming about the future."
I mean, talking about like planning and all this stuff, I know it's slightly controversial to some of us out there, but I feel like the PBS special, it really did show off this side, especially that back half of the episode whenever it started really diving into Walt Disney World and well, even more of the construction of Disneyland and then into the initial planning on Epcot. I mean, just the way he saw stuff, the way he planned stuff, even though that documentary wasn't well-rounded enough, you can't argue that Walt Disney was a genius in terms of planning, and he kept the good people around him to make him even better. So,
oh, absolutely. And what's amazing is as we get more into our series, we're going to find out that Walt was thinking of Epcot. This, he would go back and forth calling it the, you know, the prototype city of tomorrow, yeah, or community of tomorrow. He was thinking about this way before they even dreamt of starting to get the land. It was fermenting in his head what he wanted to do, what his plans were. And we're going to look at some of even what he built at Disneyland was a testing ground for what was going to be in Epcot.
I'm excited for that then.
Now, speaking of Disneyland, Disneyland was Walt's personal project. It was, what was unique about it is that it was one man's vision who had the singular ability to persuade others, like you were saying, Craig, to go along with him on his personal journey. Walt found talented artists who could visualize and implement his ideas. The park reflected one man's tastes and choices, and Walt made all the decisions. And could it survive when its father and guiding light was lost? And I always have said if Walt had one fault, it was that he did everything. Everything was centralized with him. And when he was gone, people didn't know what to do. And it was like Roy O. Disney said, if Walt had not had plans laid out for 3 to 5 years, I think the Disney company really would have had a rough go of it after Walt died, because they really did ride out those first few years carrying out everything he had already planned.
And that's so scary to think of, just because I've not known Disneyland for a very long time at all. I went once in 1999, and then It might have, yeah, it was 1999. And then I didn't go back until I started working with the Diz. And now I've been back many, many times. And I will always be the first to volunteer to go back to Disneyland anytime I'm given the opportunity. But in general, though, like, I can't imagine that there was ever any issues for it, because I walk into that park and it's so magical. And the fact that there was this turmoil and wondering what they would do, it's mind boggling. But at the same time, they figured it out, because it's the happiest place on earth.
Yeah, still is. And they did. And it's sort of, they needed maybe that time to carry out Walt's plans as they started to think ahead for their, you know, what was going to go beyond, you know, Walt, you know, after Disney.
Exactly.
You know, so now Disneyland, though, was the starting point for Walt's secret project, as we've been alluding to, that had been consuming much of his time and interest in the last years of his life. Now, with the success of Disneyland, Walt was almost immediately confronted with two problems. The first was the urban design problems that had developed outside the perimeter of the park. Walt was horrified by the lack of cohesion the Anaheim City Council had shown when granting building permits for the cheap motor inns and fast food restaurants that had created an urban clutter. And it was much worse back then than it is now, where they've tried to beautify it. He was mystified that those who profited off the guests at Disneyland didn't follow the aesthetics and planning precedent of Disneyland in their endeavors. And the second problem was Walt being constantly approached about building a Disneyland replica in another part of the country. However, Walt wanted more than just a second theme park. He produced sequels to films carefully and thoughtfully, and then only if there was an interesting new story to tell. Now, Walt had built Disneyland in the face of opposition, skepticism, and financial challenges. So now that it was successful, he wasn't interested in merely repeating himself. So the spark of inspiration, even before that, Walt's opposition to a second Disneyland did get weakened as his organization at WED, which is now we know as WED Imagineering, matured in its skills. Walt saw something beyond simply duplicating Disneyland, and he concluded that another Disneyland could be used as the weenie to accomplish his greater vision. And that's planning and building a new kind of city that would show how people could live in a clean, handsome, and stimulating community.
And I don't believe you're talking about Celebration, because I don't think anyone would call that clean, handsome, or stimulating.
You know, I've never been there.
Oh, Michael, I'll have to take you the next time you're out there. It is a lovely town, and I'm not saying anything bad about it, but Celebration was huge in the 90s because everyone thought that this was that Disney town. This was it. And then, you know, now since I've been here, then I look at it, it's not that utopia that you would expect. And at some points, like the movie theater that hasn't been used in years, it's a bit run down. I don't think that would ever be in a Walt Disney plan for anything.
No, and Disney divested itself of Celebration, didn't it?
Yes, they did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but yeah, you're right. That was sort of Michael Eisner's attempt at building the Epcot community.
Yep.
And there were a few elements that was more like the CC&Rs, mm-hmm, that did hail back to some of Walt's concepts for Epcot. But the spark of inspiration for this city might be traced to the design and construction of Walt Disney's Burbank studio in the late 1930s, because Walt planned the Burbank facility in every detail, down to the contour of the animator's chair. Disneyland was also the product of Walt's meticulous planning, and within the berm of the park, it worked. But Walt was appalled by how the promoters made what he called a second-rate Las Vegas out of the surrounding area. So after spending his adult life in Los Angeles, because we all know that he went there in 1923 for D23,
yep,
Walt had witnessed how the automobile had changed a sunny, attractive town into a concrete, paved, smoke-choked metropolis. So he wanted to combat the use of, combat the tyranny of the car and restore a degree of the comfortable life his generation had known earlier in the century. So the secret project of Walt's would be Walt Disney's very greatest. This was his legacy. It was called Project X, and Walt envisioned it as the home of his most passionate dream, his future city, the community of tomorrow. Now, Walt always liked to provide guests with a preview of what they would see with all his projects. So, for example, if you saw Saving Mr. Banks, you know, when at the scene where they visit Disneyland, you see that there were attraction posters once lining the front entrance of Disneyland in front of the Mickey Mouse flowered mural. And then they also lined the tunnel entrances to Disneyland. Walt did this to give guests a preview of what to expect within Disneyland, much as the attraction posters in front of a theater let you know what's going on inside the theater.
And I wish they would still do, both Disneyland and Walt Disney World, I wish they would put the posters out front like that again instead of inside the tunnels. I mean, that's great, but looking at those old pictures of it lining up around there, it's just, it's classy.
Now, in many ways, the 1967 reimagining of Disneyland's Tomorrowland gave guests a preview of what Walt was contemplating for his community of tomorrow in Florida. Disneyland's 1967 Tomorrowland was called A World on the Move, and the architecture from the people mover beamways to the curves of the buildings were all very organic. I mean, the beamways of the people mover almost looked like they were growing out of the ground.
Can I ask you a question on that? So I know obviously the people mover ended up becoming rocket rods for a time, but all the beams, was anything changed for that, or is that still all of the original track from all the way back then?
That's the original track, which is why Rocket Rods was unsuccessful.
Well, then I completely agree with your words here. Yeah, it's it's beautiful still looking at those, despite, well, there's nothing on them.
Now this Tomorrowland featured the now signature clean, crisp, white, mid-century modern structures that gave the area an aesthetic of flight and the United States space program. So in this Tomorrowland, and Craig, have you seen like photos or videos of the 67 Tomorrowland?
Yes, I have.
Now, there was a variety of transportation technologies on several levels that gave this realm the theme of a world on the move. So, you know, high above Tomorrowland were the Astro Orbiter spinning rockets and the Skyway. And then just below those attractions was the perpetually moving people mover on its curved pylons, and then the sleek monorail train of the future. And then at ground level with the guests was Utopia. And then below the guests and beneath the water were the submarines. So the design of Tomorrowland was really incredible, where the Imagineers had to layer all these attractions.
I honestly never thought about how much transportation was solely right in there. It just, it never dawned on me.
I mean, everything moved when you see the videos of this. Even the Carousel of Progress building moved as it rotated from scene to scene. So the movement in this land was an attraction in itself. And in his Community of Tomorrow, Walt determined the people mover and the monorail would be the backbones of transportation throughout the entire community. Now, another preview of what this community of tomorrow would be was Walt Disney's vision for tomorrow, his vision for the future. And I was at a recent presentation at the Walt Disney Family Museum in San Francisco, where producer and director Brad Bird, who we all know him for his work on Pixar films.
And
Tomorrowland.
Yes.
The film Tomorrowland.
Of course, yes.
Talked about the change in our society's vision for the future. Did you like the film Tomorrowland?
I originally, whenever I saw it, I enjoyed it. And then after some reflecting and after I wrote a review on it, I started disliking it more in my head. But then recently I was, I want to say maybe on the way back from California from D23, I watched it on the airplane, and I enjoyed it. Again, it still has some flaws in it, and I think the Blu-ray coming out soon that will actually have deleted scenes and start connecting those pieces of Walt that they took out, I think then it could make for a more well-rounded movie. I would rather see them all in the places that they're going to be instead of just as deleted scenes, but I don't think they have any plans on doing that director's cut as of right now.
Yeah, that would be nice. Yeah, I agree with you. I enjoyed it very much, and I was disappointed with what must have been left on the cutting room floor. Yeah. And I'm looking forward to seeing it again.
Just thank goodness we live in a day where we do have special features that we're still able to go back and see these things that really aren't meant for anyone else. Just such a progression from VHS.
Yes. Oh, yeah, definitely. Now, one of the things that Brad Bird brought up was, you know, in my day when I was a boy, the future was positive and full of possibilities. And now, and we saw that in television, we saw that in film, we saw that in our weekly readers with, you know, we were going to have flying cars and robot teachers and all this kind of stuff. But now when you look at our entertainment that deals with the future, we seem to have accepted an apocalyptic future. So it's almost as if, you know, we had better enjoy the good times now. And so in his presentation, Brad Bird discussed this change in our view of the future, and he theorized that our society's positive concept of a positive future open to all possibilities was tied directly to Walt Disney's vision of a great, big, beautiful tomorrow. Because at that time, we believed what Walt Disney said. We're going places and there's progress ahead. And when you think about it, you know, people talk about all the turmoil in the world now. Well, when you think back to like in the 50s and 60s when I was young, it was the height of the Cold War. It was the Cuban Missile Crisis, which brought us to the brink of nuclear war. It was playing out. The world was just as imperfect then as now. But then everyone agreed would solve the problems and rise above them.
Yeah, we do have a very passive outlook on everything right now, and I don't know, maybe it's just me, but it seems like especially in terms of what you were saying with the great big beautiful tomorrow and that apocalyptic future, it just even down to simple stuff like technology. I mean, the classic example is a flying car, and it seemed like just looking at movies and stuff from the past about like, oh, one day there might be flying cars, and it's possible to get there one day. Now ours is, well, yeah, I don't foresee that ever happening. So who's trying? And yeah, hopefully there are people still out there trying for that stuff. But is it likely? Or are we just all negative and very passive on wanting to do anything about it anymore?
Yeah, and now everything is about the the post-nuclear war world.
Yeah, and well, yeah. Hopefully that never happens. Fingers crossed.
Really. Yeah, but again, I think it goes back to what Brad Bird was positing, is that our sense of the future was tied to Walt Disney. You think about, who was Walt Disney? He was a man whose favorite president was Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln was a progressive. Walt was suspicious of banks. For proof, look to how bankers are portrayed in the Mary Poppins story arc of a man valuing his business over his children. Walt loved nature and was a conservationist. He started the whole nature films. Yeah. If you listen to my segment on the Disneyland show I did a couple years ago on the Mineral King ski resort project, first and foremost, Walt wanted it to sort of blend in with the natural surroundings and the nature so that you wouldn't even see the ski resort from a distance. Walt Disney loved advancement and was an innovator. Brad Bird outlined several examples of this through Walt Disney's many achievements, including, you know, Walt did the first sound cartoons, the first Technicolor cartoons, the first cartoon without dialogue, which is the Silly Symphony skeleton dance. He designed the multi-plane camera to create depth in his characters. And when you think about it, look at Snow White, rewatch Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Is there a film that looks as breathtaking and cool as 1937 Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs?
Nope. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, mine too. Even when I was watching those clips on the PBS series on Walt Disney, it just reminded me what a dazzling film that continues to be.
Oh yeah, it's one of my sick day movies. So anytime I'm not feeling well, which isn't often, but anytime I am, I seem to always want to just put that on and watch it for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, now Fantasia, think of that. It didn't have a narrative, and it was recorded in stereo sound called Fantasound, which is now considered to be the predecessor of surround sound. So Wald had Fantasound installed in 5 theaters, but with the start of World War II and the closing of the overseas market, Fantasound was halted. Mm-hmm. Now, Walt believed Fantasia would never be completed, as segments would be added and removed over the years. And this sounds just like Disneyland and how it would never be completed so long as there was imagination left in the world.
Random, but when do you think we'll see the next part of Fantasia coming out, if ever?
I would be surprised if we ever did, unless John Lasseter really felt motivated to do it.
And I feel like he's the person who would get it done. So,
yeah.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, I agree. So, then Brad Bird went on to talk about Walt Disney's vision as a science fiction storyteller. And you think, well, wait, Walt Disney didn't make science fiction feature films. But whilst other studios were doing Forbidden Planet, When the Earth Stood Still, and War of the Worlds, which are all excellent films, and amongst my favorite as a boy, Walt was producing 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea in CinemaScope and stereophonic sound.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, to this day, Forbidden Planet's still great. And When the Earth Stood Still and World of Worlds are all classics. But 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea is, I mean, it's just beautiful cinema compared to all of those. So that says a lot. But I don't know if you were going to talk about it, but even though we didn't get the feature films really with a lot of science fiction, at least you did have some of the pieces that were made for the television series. Mm-hmm. So,
right. Yeah, we'll get into that, because that really is where his science fiction storytelling could be seen.
Yeah.
So while most of the other studios' films were apocalyptic in theme, like all the ones that we just mentioned, but Walt Disney's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea ends with Captain Nemo saying, "There is hope for the future. When the world is ready for a new and better life, all this will someday come to pass in God's good time." Again, this is a reflection of Walt's positive outlook for the future. And like you were saying, Craig, Walt Disney's science fiction storytelling could be seen in his weekly television show, in which he presented science episodes regularly.
Yeah.
And of course, the most famous, you're probably thinking the same thing, are Ward Kimball's Man in Space series.
Yep.
Yeah, and that was adapted for classroom use, and a print was requested by President Eisenhower to screen at the Pentagon. And take a look at those, because when you watch that series of films, and they're available on the Walt Disney Treasures series in the tins,
yep.
And then think of our moon mission and our shuttle program, there's a tremendous amount of similarities.
Oh, yeah. No, these are beautiful, and I highly recommend getting that Tomorrowland tin about the whole space series in it. And you can actually still find new unsealed copies of it on eBay for reasonable prices. I don't have this one unsealed at all. And I almost bought it a couple weeks ago for only like $20, brand new still. So they're out there if you're really invested in learning more about the past. Or you can rent them on Netflix sometimes.
Yeah, and definitely it's worth it. Those are amongst the best.
Yeah.
I think, in that series.
Agree.
No, perhaps the most significant accomplishment of Walt Disney, and it wasn't in the PBS series, was audio animatronics. With shows like The Carousel of Progress, Walt created shows that performed endlessly. The Robin and Mary Poppins was the first audio animatronic figure in a film. And audio animatronic changed films. I mean, Craig, could films like E.T., Jurassic Park, and this, like, could they have been made without audio animatronics?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, yeah, there's also stories out there about huge flubs whenever you're trying to use audio animatronics with movies. You know, Jaws, So,
yeah.
But at the same time, it's, yeah, that Robin, there's a special feature. I want to say it's maybe on the Mary Poppins Blu-ray or maybe even the Saving Mr. Banks one. It's out there somewhere, but they showed how the whole technology in getting, running the cords through her and just getting that thing to work. And no, it that was such a big change. And, you know, at the end of the day, say whatever you want about Disneyland, anything. Walt Disney, one of his biggest legacies of all was audio animatronics, because it's been adapted into so many things beyond just Disney.
Yeah, there's a funny story that Julie Andrews told, where because of the way the Robin was, you know, on her arm and all that, she had to always keep her arm elevated. So even in between takes, so there's this great scene of her where it's in between takes. She's sitting reading a newspaper in one hand with her arm in the air holding the Robin.
That's great.
Because she couldn't put her arm down. Now, Brad Bird then went on to talk about Walt Disney as a futurist. So in a 1958 segment of Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color, Walt explored what the future would look like. And it would be very centered around the highway and how cars and highways allowed people to move around freely. But even back in 1958, Walt expressed concern over the increasingly crowded highways. So as I mentioned earlier, Walt could express his vision of the future in Disneyland's Tomorrowland, and this is the one realm of the park that continually needs to be rebuilt and reimagined because the future is always changing.
Yep.
And this frustrates the businessmen in the Walt Disney Corporation because Tomorrowland requires frequent updating. So the businessmen try to lock this down. In Disneyland Paris, they themed Tomorrowland to Jules Verne and the tomorrow of the past. In Disneyland and the Magic Kingdom, they try to resolve this by relying heavily on science fantasy, like Star Tours, Buzz Lightyear's Astro Blasters, Stitch's Great Escape, and, you know, the Monsters, Inc. Laugh Floor.
Because that is the world of tomorrow.
Yes, monsters telling jokes.
Exactly.
Now, I and Brad Bird do agree that the best Tomorrowland ever built is the 1967 Disneyland Tomorrowland, and this was the last project supervised by Walt Disney. So to round this out, Walt Disney's vision for the future molded the plans for his experimental prototype Community of Tomorrow, Epcot. And since the beginning of Disneyland, urban planners were impressed with how Disneyland handled crowds, was clean, and the rides handled large numbers of people. So for his Florida project, Walt purchased 27,400 acres of land, or 43 square miles. That's twice the size of Manhattan, and one square mile larger than San Francisco.
It blows my mind every time I hear that, considering multiple times a week I'm driving all over that property, and you just never even put it together.
I know, and since I was raised in San Francisco, that size means much more to me than Manhattan.
Yeah.
I thought, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So, now, there was a lot of nervousness about Disney having so much land. Environmentalists were concerned until they learned Disney standards are 3 to 4 times higher than government standards. And so Walt Disney was ultimately given carte blanche to develop what he wanted on the land. And for Walt Disney, money was the fuel to create and do new things. So as Walt developed his plans for the Florida project, at the heart of the project was always the environmental prototype Community of Tomorrow, Epcot, where they will always be testing and using new materials. It would be a showcase for ingenuity and industry to solve urban ills and dedicated to the happiness of those who work, live, and play there. So the most important part of Disney World, the whole reason for doing it, was never built, Epcot.
Which is such a shame. You know, the closest thing we have to the Epcot that Walt wanted was whenever you go past it in our Tomorrowland Transit Authority, and you see it just as you're driving by, and then there it goes.
Right.
Sad.
Yeah. And the transportation and ticket center, that was all part of it, too, because he was going to have you were going to drive in and go to a central hub, and then take monorails and people movers and all that out to the other areas.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Walt hoped Epcot would stimulate human ingenuity, and Brad Bird suggested, though, that we can keep the concept of Epcot alive by seeing Epcot as a challenge that we imagine. And I think he sort of brought this out in the Tomorrowland film. What we need to do is visualize the future we want and drive towards it with our actions and turn our society's vision of the future back to a positive one. So at the heart of our Connecting with Walt episodes is our goal to illustrate how Walt's vision continues to be reflected throughout the Disney organization, even in modern day projects. So throughout October, Craig and I hope you'll join us on our exploration of the early development of Walt's Florida project.
Yay.
Yeah. it'll be a fun journey together.
I'm excited.
Me too. So next week in episode 2, which is titled You Can't Top Pigs with Pigs, we'll examine several of the offers Walt received after the opening of Disneyland to build other Disneylands around the United States. And Walt politely turned the offers down because he disliked repeating himself. However, some offers piqued his interest, and we'll take a look at some of those proposals. In episode 3, which is called The Search Ends and the Mystery Unfolds, we'll discuss the pressure Walt was under to either move forward or reject the proposals to build another park. After a November 1963 plane tour of potential sites, Walt made his decision, and Craig and I will examine that tour and how the Disney Company secretly moved forward with the project and how it became public. In episode 4, The Master Plan, we'll take a look at Walt Disney's vision for his Florida project, which included many of the resort amenities we're familiar with today, and we'll also examine Walt's concept for a city of the future. To end the month of October with episode 5, The Torch is Passed On, we'll discuss the effect Walt's passing had on the Florida project and how it progressed with his brother Roy O. Disney taking the project on as his crusade. So I think we have a lot of exciting episodes coming up.
Oh yeah, I already know. I'm going to learn a lot. I'm going to contribute as much as I can, but there's a lot that I still don't know, and I'm just so excited to learn.
Good. Yeah, well, me too. I have a whole pile of books right next to me that I'm pouring through right now. Gosh,
I need to start getting some audiobooks or something.
So, I know, I wish I could listen to them in my sleep and absorb the information.
We can only try.
So now, Craig, until next time, where can our listeners find you?
Oh, the best place for people to find me is at my house, but I'm not going to tell you where that is. So if you just want to find me anywhere else, well, social media is obviously the best place. So I'm on Twitter. My handle is at Teleclaster. And then I'm also on Facebook, Craig Williams. If you're friends with one person on the Diz, you'll easily be able to find me. I don't answer to requests that quickly, so I do apologize for that. And then I am, besides doing all the other shows that I do, like the Disney World show and the Universal show, I'm also doing a lot of posts for all of the social media with the Diz on Twitter and on Facebook. So yeah, if you're ever wanting to see stuff that I'm doing, even check out the Diz on Instagram. That we are instagram.com/thediz and the.diz. My apologies. And if everyone out there goes and follows that, I would be very appreciative of that. But yep, those are all the places I'm at. What about you?
And you have a lot of good photos on Instagram of Disneyland, Disney World, Universal. It's all well balanced.
We try. Corey and I are the only people that typically ever put anything up on there, and we work hard, but it's fun.
Yeah, well, to understand Walt Disney World, it is critical to understand Walt Disney and Disneyland, because without Walt and Disneyland, there would be no Walt Disney World. So I hope you will join me, Tom, Nancy, Mary, Joe, and Tony on the Diz Unplugged podcast Disneyland edition. We record the show live on Mixlr each Sunday night at 8 p.m. Pacific time, Disneyland time. The show is available on Mondays with additional segments on Tuesdays. And for more about the history of Walt Disney and Disneyland, please check out my history segments on the Disneyland Podcast Archives. Craig, where can they find our archives?
Disunplug.com.
Perfect.
Right?
Yeah, and you can...
Right?
Yeah. Yes, that's what I have saved. And you can save me messages. You can send me messages at michael@wdwinfo.com. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at it's mbowling121. And I'm also on Instagram, Michael Bowling the Diz. So you can find me in all kinds of places. And I live in a small town, so listeners actually do know where I live. So Craig, do you have any final words?
I want to thank everyone out there for taking the time to listen to this, and hopefully everyone jumps on board with it, because there's going to be so many good things to come with this. And most of all, thank you for taking the time to really do all of the grunt work on here and let me be a part of it, because I'm very excited about it.
I am too. This has been great fun. And for our listeners, please tell your friends, especially if they're Disney fans and want to know a little more about their favorite passion, Disney, and have them listen to the show. And thank you for making us a part of your day. And remember, I only hope that we don't lose sight of one thing, that it was all started by a man, Walt Disney. Thank you.